When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a podcast from The Times, sports newspaper of the year.
Hello and welcome to The Game, here with a definitive opinion from an action-packed weekend in the Barclays Premier League. I don't normally say Barclays, but, you know, I just thought we need to show some love to the sponsors because, as I found out when I went to get out cash the other day, if I ask for a receipt, which I'll most likely throw on the ground, thereby littering, I have a chance to win two tickets, to a Premier League game, which got me all excited.
Other banks are available.
Yes, but you don't get a chance to win. And by the way, personally, I bank with HSBC, and I'm very happy with them. Joining me to provide said opinion, I have Rory Smith, whose preferred bank is?
The Halifax.
Clive Petty, who's opted for?
NatWest.
And Ollie Kay, who owns Coutts. Coming up, we'll discuss what happened at the Emirates. Was the game worth £62? We'll also be asking if the Atlantic League could save not just Scottish football, but Dutch football, Belgian football, Portuguese football, and all sorts of formerly great footballing nations, or whether it's just a stupid idea. But obviously, we're going to be starting at Old Trafford, Manchester United and Liverpool. Ollie, I don't know if this was the first game back for Vidic and Ferdinand. I'm assuming it wasn't. But I thought the two of them did okay. I know there was some suggestion, you know, Evans, whatever else, but it worked, right?
Well, it did. I mean, I didn't think they defended particularly well in the last half hour. They sort of invited a lot of pressure forward, which clearly wasn't the defender's fault. But they were troubled a lot by the running of Suarez and Sturridge. And I thought Ferdinand did very well. I thought Vidic did well under the circumstances, but looked a little bit rusty. But on the whole, I would say Ferdinand Vidic did well without looking like anything like the partnership of 3 years ago.
Clive, I want to start with Ollie, obviously, but I want to check in a stat here because for those who like history, the record. I'll quiz you. Do you know who holds the record for most points in a single top flight season?
Chelsea with 95.
Yeah. There you go. See, he's good.
Manchester, I'd have said that given the chance, but you know.
Manchester United are on pace to equal that record, which I find extraordinary because that Chelsea side looked so dominant. This United side, we've been saying it all season, you know, we can all see areas where they can improve. Kagawa's been injured. Rooney's injured now. Vidic was injured. You look at this and you say, goodness, if they all start playing consistently well, then they have a chance to beat Chelsea's record, even though Chelsea looked a lot more dominant, I think, and you know, when they set the record, than United do now.
I think it's kind of built on different things, wasn't it? Chelsea was almost built on you will not beat us. It was a good, solid base, and then built on a sort of defensive, you won't break us down, and then we'll have the big guys who will break you down and score. Whereas United, purely surviving on their attack at the moment, as far as I can see. And Robin Van Persie and Welbeck had a great game yesterday. They're scoring enough goals, but they do look vulnerable. Ollie's right. And if any other team, if it hadn't been Liverpool yesterday, any other team with a bit more nous about them, I mean, Liverpool did well. Took the game to them in that last half hour, and United did look very shaky. And I was under the impression that any other team on their mettle may well have at least come away with a point there, and we'd have been talking about something completely different. So they are on course for 95, but the comparison with Chelsea is slightly different. There's, I think, United, if they keep scoring and Van Persie keeps fit and they keep going forward, that's how they're going to do it. But they can't rely on defending like they did yesterday.
Well, so Rory, what conclusion can we draw? I mean, can we conclude that they can actually be much better than they are?
Or do you look at it the other way and say that that at some point their luck will run out? I don't know. It's very hard to draw conclusions or to come to sort of definitive decisions about this United side, because you look at it and you do think, right, well, they essentially don't have any sort of holding midfield player. They don't have any sort of shield in front of the defence. The defence itself looks a bit shaky. They're conceding loads of goals. Van Persie's getting them out of jail a lot. But on the other hand, their attack's firing perfectly and has all season. They look great going forward. So it's... They're kind of one and the other, do you know what I mean? It's very hard to say, well, it's definitely this, and if they did this, they'll be better, and if they stop doing this, then they'll be worse. I think they're kind of a... I don't know, it's... I don't want to say that it's happened by chance, that would undermine the work that they've done, but it's very hard to see whether they are the side that could improve and be dominant or the side that could get slightly worse and be mediocre.
Ollie, I remember a year or two ago, this is what I was going to ask you about, we used to have these sort of cliches about, well, you know, if you lose four games in a season, then there's no way you can win the Premier League, and, you know, people said it as if it was a fact. Mm. Manchester United have already lost three games this year. I think we can probably safely say that was just a very stupid statement to make. Yeah.
Well, I think avoiding defeat is perhaps overrated. If you look at the last few seasons, I think there was a season where Liverpool lost fewer games than Manchester United, but ended up finishing second. Manchester City have lost fewer games than United this season. The fact is that, you know, 3 points for a win. United are extremely good at winning matches, extremely good at knowing what to do, even if they're sort of 1-0 down with 10 minutes left. And I think the longer United win matches, I don't think they will concede, you know, I don't think they'll worry if they lose one match a month.
I thought that is absolutely true, that drawing is completely overrated. At the end of the QPR Spurs game on Saturday lunchtime, QPR got a throw in with 30 seconds of injury time left, and you could see Redknapp telling Sean Derry, I think, not to, you know, to hold the ball, not to get on with the throw in.
Keep the clean sheet.
Surely with 30 seconds to go, you've got a throw in. It was 5 yards from Spurs' touchline. You put two or three players in the box and you see what happens. Surely, I mean, a point's not worth that much to anyone at either end of the table.
Yeah, although you are playing against a team with Gareth Bale and Aaron Lennon, who are faster than God, and then you run the length of the pitch in no time flat and boom.
But your reward is greater than your risk, because if you lose 1 point, then that's bad. But it's not going to make the difference. If you gain two, it could be hugely important.
I see the logic in that, but Clive is making a face.
Well,
so no,
I do see the logic of that. It's, I'm wondering whether QPR in their position, I can see that logic perhaps further forward, but in QPR in their position, they're playing Tottenham. It's kind of like that point is kind of like a bonus point.
Absolutely. But they'd already kind of got the point, assuming right. That Gareth Bale's not going to run the length of the pitch.
Assuming that Gareth Bale can do what he
and
says.
I think what United have done is they've recognised that I don't know what the stats are, but United don't seem to be drawing games. City draw a lot of games.
They've only drawn one. That was the cup replays, the only draw they've had all season.
Moving on, so obviously there was this change in the game because United, you know, looked in control. I think Ollie wrote in his match report that they looked in control without necessarily looking uber dominant. It was more of a mature performance. But then something changed. Ollie, what changed?
They seemed to take the foot off the gas. Liverpool had already got Sturridge on, and they seemed to release the handbrake a little bit and go for it. And then I think it's been a familiar trend for Liverpool at Old Trafford to only start playing at 2-0 down in recent seasons. Liverpool went for it a little bit, started to cause problems, pulled a goal back quickly, and I think from that point on Liverpool looked confident and United looked nervous. And looking at the final probably 37 minutes, you would struggle to see how I think Liverpool will be kicking themselves that they didn't get that second goal, because they had enough possession and enough time to make more of what they did in the closing stages.
So if you're Sir Alex, would you be worried about that?
Not at all, really. I think if he was going to be overly worried about United's problems at times when there's a flow of attacking football upon them, you know, they struggle to stem that flow. It's something that they've struggled with for 4 or 5 seasons, but it hasn't stopped them winning the Premier League more often than not. It hasn't stopped them reaching the latter stages of the Champions League more often than not. And I think if he was going to worry about it, he would have bought a defensive midfielder or changed the way they play at times long ago.
Clive, what changed for Liverpool is just the fact that they're 2-0 down. Like, all right, we need to do something. Chuck on Sturridge and, you know, enough for the Joe Allen sideways passing.
Yeah, Joe Allen was a very poor game. Sturridge's pace combined with Suarez, I mean, when they came on, they did link up quite well. I mean, there was quite a nice link up of sort of short passes between the two of them, and that pace, and Suarez had a bit more space to suddenly start running at them, and that did worry, you know, a tiring Fernand, a tiring Vidic. But I think, more to the point, it said a lot about Liverpool in that this only started at 2-0 down. I'm not quite, perhaps there is something in that idea of, you know, they started quite timidly. They're 2-0 down. Oh dear. Well, you know, let's see what we can do now. And the game was, you know, that's hard enough to do against a lot of teams, like against Manchester United at Old Trafford. I think it says something about perhaps the mentality of Liverpool that they did only really try doing this at 2-0 down, and suddenly it became 2-1 and they thought, oh, actually we could get something out of this, and it pressed on. The surprising thing was that United didn't actually see this themselves, as far as I could work out, and suddenly thought, oh, blimey, we're in a bit of danger here. Let's step up a gear again. They didn't seem to do that, and it did encourage Liverpool. But as I say, I think it was more of a Liverpool thing that they only started playing almost when the game was gone. And if they can stop, get that out of it, who knows what might have happened.
Ollie, but Sturridge is a very different player from Downing. Was it a case that they just started playing then, or was it a case that they're like, all right, we need to do something, let's throw caution to the wind here, and add this sort of dimension of directness?
I think it was a bit of that. I mean, Liverpool's forward, you know, Liverpool's attacking play for the first 50 minutes was pretty much non-existent. I think just before the Vidic goal, there was that chance which Suarez set up for Wisdom on the counter-attack. So, they had finally begun to emerge from the shell just before United scored their second. But, as I said earlier, there has been this sort of repeated issue with Liverpool under three different managers now. The last three games at Old Trafford, last three league games at Old Trafford, certainly, they've been 2-0 down early in the second half, and only then have they really started playing. I think Liverpool are developing a, it seems like they're developing a bit of an inferiority complex again where United are concerned. I mean, it's probably understandable because they are, this team is far inferior to United's, and they have been so for the last few years. They will look back on it as an opportunity missed.
Rory, you get the final word on this. Brendan Rodgers says that there really aren't 24 points difference between these two clubs. The way he says it doesn't fully make sense to me, because he says, well, the difference is depth, but then, depth obviously impacts performance and whatever else. But if you had to kind of judge where he is at this stage, vis-a-vis the expectations, vis-a-vis some of the choices that have been made, and the way Liverpool are playing, what grade do you give him thus far?
I guess probably, a B, I suppose. B, maybe a C plus. I think the issue that Liverpool have is that there is, among Liverpool fans, there is a feeling that you look at the first team, and you've got players like Sturtle and Agger and Lucas, Joe Allen to an extent, and you think, do you know what, these are good players. Like, most Liverpool fans, when City came in for Agger in the summer, would have said, if Daniel Agger goes to a top side, he will be a top class centre back. He's a brilliant ball player, reads the game really well. But I think the issue that Liverpool now have to face, and the reality they probably have to face, is that those players aren't good enough to get them out of the situation they're in. Where Rodgers is eighth in the Premier League. That's where Liverpool are at the moment. What tends to happen with these podcasts is that I say something, then get loads of abuse on Twitter from loads of Liverpool fans. I think players like Sturtle, Agger, and Lucas are all great footballers, and they would get into most Premier League teams. What I don't think they are is good enough to lift Liverpool out of their slump. I don't want that to be the case. It just looks like it is.
So if I may interpret your thought, a couple more Gerrards and Suarez's, and then a young Gerrard perhaps, and then Lucas and Skrtel are fine as sort of like to fill in the 11.
They're good quality Premier League players. They're not enough to take Liverpool to the next level.
I'm moving on to the Emirates, Arsenal and City. Obviously, this game changed early on, but I think it actually probably changed even before Koscielny's red card when Arteta went out. And we've talked about Arsenal's lack of a defensive midfielder. We sort of stopped talking about it because it looked as if, you know, Arteta, I wouldn't call him a defensive midfielder, but he fills that position. He fouls people when he needs to. He gets in the way. But then, of course, he goes out, and there's nobody. And then you got to, you know, chuck in Diaby, who's played 5 minutes in the last couple months because the poor guy's always hurt. Were Arsenal kind of up against it even before kickoff as a result, Roy?
Yeah, it's difficult to draw huge conclusions from a game where one team goes down to 10 men after 10 minutes. But, yeah, Arteta, no question, hugely important. He gives Arsenal a degree of control. He isn't, you're right, he's not a tough tackling midfield hard man, but he reads the game well. He organises the midfield well, which is an incredibly underrated quality. Although he's not been as good this season as he was last, I don't think, in my personal opinion. Yeah, I think that set to Arsenal back. But in terms of Liverpool's tentativeness and timidity, Arsenal were timid even before Koscielny got sent off. Arsenal looked like a side who didn't think they were as good as Manchester City.
They did seem to lack a spark. They didn't seem, I mean, as Wenger says, even with 10 men, there's no reason. You should still be able to organise yourself if you're a team such as Arsenal, that you don't concede you try not to concede as much as anything else. And they didn't look organised. They didn't have enough work rate amongst the middle of the park. I mean, as you say, can't really blame Diaby. He's 5 minutes since September, I think, the guy's played. So to throw him in against the champions was a big ask. But they seemed to just think that Wilshere was going to do everything for them, and that's never going to be enough against most teams, let alone Manchester City. So it was difficult to judge facing the 80 minutes, but I would have expected a lot more organisation from what is now an experienced Arsenal team.
I think the thing is that Arsenal never looked like... Having 10 men for 80 minutes is a massive disadvantage. It's not a death sentence.
No.
Arsenal never looked like they had a way out of that situation, even when Dzeko had missed the penalty. You never looked at that and thought, yeah, Arsenal can think their way out of this problem.
That would have given a lot of teams a boost. They're sort of like, we've conceded a penalty just so, and they got a huge let off. To use a sort of Stuart Pearce analogy, there was no, let's build from here. They just went on exactly the same merry way.
Ollie, when Koscielny basically just bear hugged Dzeko, did last week we had the whole sort of Suarez like crucifixion over the cheating and so on. Rory's nodding along, so I'm guessing he likes where I'm going with this. I might just throw it to him. From a sportsmanship cheating perspective, is this comparable to Suarez or some of the worst dives that we see?
Well, no. I guess the point with dives and handballs, if you don't like that sort of thing, is that you're not getting punished. You're not serving your penalty for committing the crime, whereas Koscielny did. My issue with that red card.
Well, no, so you are. If you get caught diving and you get a yellow.
Oh yeah, if you get caught, but people don't get angry. If you get caught, people get angry when people get away with it.
Right.
So my issue with the Koscielny red. Now, it was unquestionably a red. Just as companies, which we'll know that come on to, was unquestionably a red under the laws as they stand. To me, and Gab will, just, you always disagree with everything everyone says, so you'll unquestionably disagree with this.
Disagree with the company, I'm sure about that.
Koscielny's crime was denying a goal scoring opportunity, yes.
Yes.
Right. Even though I think Dzeko had probably misjudged the flight of the ball, but looked like he denied a goal scoring opportunity. The punishment for that is the penalty. To me, the red card, I understand the calls for consistency. We've got referees always like automata have to constantly sort of interpret the rules the same way all the time. There can be no context, blah blah blah. The punishment for me is the penalty. That's restoring the goal scoring opportunity. I think sending the player off as well in that circumstance
and suspending him
is overkill.
Yeah, well, this is a good point. I mean, personally, I don't think that the penalty alone could be punishment, because otherwise we're going to see players like your pal Suarez standing on goal lines and handling the ball and whatnot. And that's exactly why this rule was introduced. But Ollie, haven't IFAB addressed this? Haven't they sort of said that referees can have more discretions, and that there's some situations where maybe you give a yellow instead of a red while avoiding a penalty?
A foul in the penalty area, even when a player is sort of the last man does not necessarily equate to a red card under the rules as they stand. It has to be the sort of clear denial of a goal scoring opportunity, and there are all sorts of things like the direction they're moving in, the speed, the you know, where the goalkeeper is, etc. So it's not as black and white as it once was. But I mean, although match officials talk about it as this sort of triple jeopardy situation where, yes, there's the penalty, there's the red card, there's the suspension. And I can understand the grievance with that. But then again, if a guy is, you know, if a team is 2-0 up in the last 5 minutes and he does it, then, you know, under a rule where players didn't get suspended, then there'd be no punishment whatsoever, really.
Exactly.
I think, you know, the idea of introducing context to these things is wrong. I don't think it should be about context. And I know people talk about common sense and referees officiating with common sense. I think referees should referee to the rules and what the rule book says, and to hell with common sense, basically.
So when Ollie runs the world, we'll have a whole army of robot automaton referees. And we'll all be much happier people.
If he's running the world, then that'll be the same. That'd be true of the police as well, which would be awful, wouldn't it? Ollie's basically unmasked himself as a fascist.
Ollie's very much a law and order type of guy. Let's just put it that way. All right, Clive, speaking of law and order, the other big contentious point here was the company red card. Now, Rory said it's a red, so I'm not going to bother going to him for a while because I know he's wrong.
I didn't say that.
He said under the laws as they stand now, it was a red card.
Okay, but that's we live in football with the laws as they stand now, not in some kind of Rory Smith utopia, right?
Not yet.
Okay, so the implication is that Mike Dean made the correct decision, right? Did he make the correct decision? Because from where I was...
No, I have to say, the first time I saw this tackle, and I've seen various angles now, and I see no reason to change my mind. If I was Vincent Kompany, I would be very upset that I got sent off for that tackle too.
Just to recap here, he wins the ball. Mm. He's not. It's not a two-footed challenge because one leg is beneath the other. He doesn't leave the ground. And most importantly, his body is never out of control. He's going directly into Wilshire's pass, and Wilshire sees him coming. I think that this is something where there's very little room for interpretation. It simply wasn't a red card. And I suspect that it's one of two things with Mike Dean. Either, you know, he had a wobbly in his mind and just saw it badly, or, as was suggested on TV, Javi Garcia, who was sort of jogging, somehow got in his way, and he didn't actually see it as clearly as he would have. In which case, though, then that's even worse for Dean, because you shouldn't give, you know, award a red card based on something you don't see, and B, you might want to kind of, you know, move your rear end, because he's actually walking as it happens. If you see the replay, he's not even trying to get in a position where he can see it happening. I'm right here, yes,
yeah,
Clive?
Thank you.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
I'm loath to agree with you, but I think you're right in that Mike Dean, I think he probably was guessing a bit. I think he saw the impact and the shape of company's tackle, which is probably equated to a number of lunging tackles that he's seen in the past. But there was no lunge here. He was less than a foot away from Wilshere when he made that tackle. It's almost impossible to make that kind of tackle without your foot leaving the floor for an instant, and that's about the only time he did it. It was for an instant he may have had, and it's almost like we've gone back to some sort of Hayes code in the films in the 30s. Anyway, what was this thing about having to keep one foot on the floor? Well, it's not a 1930s sex scene we're filming here. He was not out of control. It was not reckless. His eyes are on the ball all the time. He wins the ball.
Final point here. I just want to check on this. As you may have heard, City got an allocation of 3,000 tickets. Arsenal priced them at £62. City did not sell out their allocation. 912 of them were returned. Some of the best writing I've seen on this, it actually comes from Ollie in Saturday's papers.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I just want to check, though, just in case. I'm mindful of the fact that Tony Evans isn't here. Does anybody think that the Premier League should legislate a maximum price for tickets or a maximum price for visiting fans?
Is it in Germany they do the visiting tickets just the same as the cheapest home ticket? Is that right? Something like that would probably be sensible.
My take.
What was the cheapest home ticket on Saturday? What wasn't the cheapest home ticket? £62 anyway.
Probably about £104. Yeah.
I think that's the point.
All right. I want to make a point about that because I go to Arsenal and Chelsea quite a lot, and people love to complain about high ticket prices and talk, the cheapest ticket is like £90. It's not really, because you buy a season ticket. People always calculate it on like the cheapest ticket for general sale. The cheapest ticket, if you look at the cost of a season ticket and divide it by the number of games, is always a lot less than the figures that are quoted in the newspapers.
So shouldn't that be reflected in the away ticket prices?
I think there's certainly an argument to do that. But I also think that there are more creative ways for people to fight this rather than by legislation. First of all, it's very bad business and bad publicity for the Premier League when you have this situation. What I might have been tempted to do if I was Sheikh Mansour, and I was worried about this financial fair play plot against me, which we all read about this morning, which none of us had ever heard about before. I might have bought out the entire ticket allocation, subsidizing myself, and told my fans to go there and erect, put like a giant banner across that area and say like, when Arsenal fans, when you come to City, you will only be charged X. Or Arsenal price gougers, or Kroenke eats his boogers, something to that effect, to embarrass the league into saying, you know what, we need to address the situation. I think it's something that the league should take for the good of the league from a business perspective, because this obviously isn't good for the league, rather than have some kind of legislation from on high.
Just on that, and I think, and I can tell we're running out of time on this, but the talk of boycotts, it wasn't really a boycott at the city end. It was more that 912 people, they couldn't find 912 people who could afford that money in this economic climate. That's totally understandable. Ticket prices are too high. Again, citing Germany as an example, the best way to make that point for fans is not to boycott games. There's 900 seats in a 60,000 stadium. You can't tell. Go to the games. Do what Dortmund do. Go to the games and then walk out. Because what the Premier League sells itself on is the spectacle of the fans, and that's where the fans are important.
I completely agree. This goes back to that. Remember the FA Cup semi-final a couple of years ago, Liverpool against Everton, I think it was? And they had it at Wembley, and they were all unhappy about tickets and whatever. I would buy your tickets to the Wembley semi-final. Goodness knows, you're a Liverpool fan. You've been there tons of time. And if you're an Everton fan, you've got... Right, maybe you haven't been there as much recently, but go do that. Buy the tickets and then don't go. Have a giant, erect giant screens in Stanley Park and watch it all together. That would have sent a big two-fingered message. But, to do that, you need fans to organize. And I think at most football clubs, certainly compared to other countries, in England, fans just aren't very organized at all.
And also it tends to come down to tribal. Even with the City-Arsenal stuff, you saw Arsenal fans thinking that they were being attacked, that sort of compared, saying, it's ironic that it's City. The City fans aren't all as rich as Sheikh Mansour. It's not a tribal issue. It's something that has to be, as you say, organised by fans in general.
In our debate this week, we're going to look at something that's been talked about for maybe at least 10 years. I wrote a column on this many years ago when Rory was just a boy. I think it was back in 2006. It's the issue of the Atlantic League, and the back, and this was raised again last week by the Rangers owner Charles Green. The basic idea is that we're in a situation where the bigger European leagues, you could say the top five, obviously there's a big jump between the Premier League and Ligue 1 in terms of revenue, although with the new Al Jazeera deal, maybe not for that long. But the bigger leagues have such an inbuilt advantage in terms of revenue, and simply because they are bigger countries, not necessarily because they're much better leagues. And it creates a vicious cycle from the perspective of the smaller countries where these people keep winning. And so you've got all these big clubs like Ajax and PSV and Anderlecht and Benfica and Celtic and Porto and Rangers who have huge crowds, who've won major European trophies. But because they play in little ditty leagues, they don't generate the TV income mostly. And they don't play against a good standard of opposition week in, week out. And so could they combine into a league, and the proposal was for the Atlantic League and involving those four nations, and actually play each other and have some sort of promotion relegation back to the domestic leagues, and they could still play in their cup competitions. And this was written off for a long time, but UEFA set a very important and little-known precedent about a year ago when they allowed the top flight of women's football in Belgium and Holland to run their own combined league. Basically, the women's clubs in those countries said, look, if you don't allow us to do this, we're not going to be competitive. It'll be too expensive. It'll be rubbish. We won't develop women's football. And so they said, okay, fine, go ahead. So in some ways, that precedent has now been set. Ollie, I want to start with you, whether this is something that can happen and maybe should happen.
If it's as a a supplement to what is already provided by the domestic leagues.
Let's be very clear on this, because people always get this wrong. It is not a supplement. It is basically a higher tier that you get promoted to and then you get relegated from.
Then I am entirely against it. I think Rangers and Celtic, whether they like it or not, their duty and their loyalty and commitment should be to Scottish football. That is where they, that is where they're based. It's not a sort of franchise type thing. That is where they're based. If Rangers or Porto or Ajax or whoever think, well, we've outgrown our domestic game, we need to go, we need to split from that and go and pursue greater revenues elsewhere. I mean, what's to stop Manchester United, Real Madrid, etc. doing the same? And obviously nothing would stop it. I think it would be awful for football. It might be good for those clubs concerned, but I'm sick of hearing that these decisions should be based on a club's revenues and so on. And
nobody's saying that. Sorry. Who said that it's a super league where it's based on revenues? You.
Well, what would be the motivation? The motivation that you cited at the start was going to be about them not generating enough money because they happen to play in smaller leagues.
Yeah.
So, yes, it would be about revenue. And I'm, as I said, I'm sick of hearing, not from you, Gab, but I'm sick of hearing from clubs that all their motivation should be about increasing revenue streams, etc., because the soul of football is just being eroded completely.
Well, I think the argument is they're increasing revenue streams to be competitive, not so it can all go into somebody's back pocket. And there are There are ways to ensure that happens. In fact, you could also make an argument that if I'm Porto, the current situation where I kind of have a subscription to the Champions League every year because I always finish in the top three and I can third-party ownership and all this fun stuff. I'm basically minting it without necessarily being as good as I could be. Clive, I want to go to you because we talk about history in the domestic league. Ollie made the point about, they're not franchises, but you go back through history in this very country, there was a situation where football was split between North and South before you all decided to go and play against each other. You even had situations in this country where to get into the top flight, you had to be elected, as you being a Spurs fan very well know. Yes, and sometimes somebody bigger and stronger screws you over.
Bigger and stronger. I'll gloss over that one quickly.
But wealthier.
But it was, you're right, it was north-south, but I get, I may be wrong, but I'm kind of guessing that that was based on a sort of geographical and just a travelling kind of aspect. It makes the league far more manageable. It was still the north of England, the south of England, and there was a like a common community thing there. The thing I don't like about the idea of an Atlantic League is it's very much the name. Even the Atlantic League, it's kind of floating out there as doing. There's no. Where's the commonality as a fan between Celtic playing Ajax, playing Porto, playing Copenhagen? Or I don't engage with those sort of fixtures, and I'm not sure fans do either. And I agree with Ollie. I think it is. I don't think it is based on a sort of a competitive, certainly a football competitive market. It's based purely on an economic market that they want to generate more money and be in a bigger pond.
All right, Rory, we've heard from these two little Englander servants of the Premier League. You and I, of course, are big Euro snobs. We were all part of a common united Europe, a Europe of the regions. Why can't we have this regional league?
I want to talk about Yugoslav football, right? So until like 1991...
Thank you, Jonathan Wilson.
...and the death of Tito, Red Star Belgrade won the European Cup. The Yugoslav clubs now are much less competitive because Dinamo Zagreb and Hajduk Split are in one league, because Red Star and Partizan are in one league, because whichever the Bosnian teams are in one league and the Slovenian team, they can't. It was much easier for them to be competitive on a European level when they were all playing each other, when you had 6, 7, 8 big clubs in the same league. Now, because of the accident of history, those nations have become separate. So that, but politics basically, the fall
so
of
if
Tito
I jump
was,
in there before we get firebombed by certain nationalists, some might say it was an accident of history that brought them.
Yeah, I really like, that is right. That's what I meant, rather than their nationhood is a problem. So it can work in reverse. So we've effectively weakened all of those teams because of politics and blah blah blah. Why can't it work so that you had a Balkan lead as long as the fans could be controlled, or an ex-Soviet lead, or a Baltic lead with Estonia, Lithuania and Latvia, a Benelux lead with Holland, Belgium and theoretically Luxembourg. I don't understand why we have to be bound by the lines of nation states. I don't think it's entirely fair on the clubs involved, as Red Star Belgrade and Partizan would probably testify, that you are at the mercy of the strength of your league.
I think those are very wise words from Rory, who I think is correct.
Jabs agreed with me. This is amazing.
Well, no, because you agreed with me. That's why I'm giving you props.
Damn it.
Hey, but Ollie, I want to get the sense here, though. I have difficulty understanding why, Aachen in Germany should benefit from being in the Bundesliga, and a team in Edinburgh or a team in Brussels should not, especially when some of these teams have, back when it was a more level playing field, showed that they could certainly compete and attract lots of people to see them and really write some of the most important pages of European history.
Well, I do take that point, but going back to the start, I mean, I said if it was done as a supplement to what's already there, if there was some kind of cup competition that brought the best, in addition to the Champions League, in addition to the Scottish League. So instead of having, the sort of ludicrous Scottish football system where, it's all divides up into playoffs and whatever, and they play each other however many times. If instead of that, there was this thing where you basically had some kind of cup in addition to Europe, and there was some incentive to get into that, and maybe it became that would generate more money for the Dutch, Belgian, Scottish, Swedish, Danish clubs, etc., then I think that would be a perfectly good idea worth exploring. But an idea which effectively kills Scottish club football and Dutch club football, and basically means that clubs like Motherwell, Hibs, etc., although they would be competing for a championship, Scottish club football would be weaker than ever because it would, there'd be no broadcast deals with Celtic Rangers, etc. It would have no marketing value. And I think it would just kill Scottish club football. And I care far more about football at a local level, at a regional level, than caring whether the big clubs are maximising their revenues or not. I care far more about a national game.
We could go on with this for a long time, Skinner might say. We have gone on for this for a long time, but I'm pleased to say that Rory and I have convinced Clive of our argument. So by a vote of 3-1, the Atlantic League passes. All right, time now for some quick hits. Spurs are held by QPR in a rather dull game. Clive, would you rather criticize Spurs or celebrate Harry and QPR?
I'd rather do neither. It was a very dull game. I don't think Spurs had the chances. I mean, it was one of those where QPR latched onto a formula that they tried at Chelsea and it worked. So this time they didn't even bother parking the bus. They didn't start it up at all. They just kept it where it was. Spurs didn't have the nous to break them well, and when they didn't have the nous to break them down, and when they did, found Cesar in the way. It was just that kind of day. I'm not going to criticise Tottenham, and I'm certainly not going to celebrate QPR. They've found, as I said, they've got 4 points out of games against Chelsea and Tottenham. They're perfectly happy, and Spurs for once didn't lose any ground in that race for the top four on a weekend. Usually when they drop points, somebody like Arsenal or Everton capitalise. This weekend, nobody did anything really, so there wasn't much to lose for Tottenham.
Sunderland pummel West Ham 3-0 with a lot of help from some horrid defensive mistakes. Ollie, define success for Martin O'Neill this season.
Success would be progress, basically. I mean, it's you know, we can look at where they should be in the league. We can look at how many points they should get. But I think after a fairly miserable 18 months or fairly miserable 2 years, apart from the period where O'Neill first arrived, I think they've basically got to capitalise on what they've done recently. They've got to start showing that they can be a team who belong in the top half, whether it's this season or next. And they've got to, you know, re-energise their support, because having been to the stadium a few times in the last few seasons, I found it a fairly depressed crowd at times. I feel like the recent results can maybe re-energise the place like O'Neill did when he first came in. So bigger attendances, getting the supporters back on side, getting better results, looking like they can be a top half team, that would be success.
Okay, so right now it doesn't look too good. Fulham draw 1-1 with Wigan, and Georgios Karagounis scores a peach of a goal. Rory, you're one of the more committed Euro snobs on this podcast. Will you celebrate the brilliant Greek veteran?
It's a little known fact that Georgios Karagounis actually worked on the original statue of Olympians Zeus with Phidias in 400 BC. He is one of the oldest men on the planet. I thought he was a slightly strange signing, Karagounis. He was a good player 8 years ago. I'd also prefer to celebrate Franco Di Santo, who also scored a very good goal.
You're just saying that because he's South American.
No, I'm not. I'm saying it because he's probably the least effective striker in the world, but he did score a very good goal. And it surprises me that Wigan are 17th, because of all the teams around the bottom, they've kind of not done that badly this season, and I thought they were doing better than that. But Karagounis fine, Di Santo fine. Slightly strange if you ask me about that game, to be honest.
Sorry, Georgios, you're not going to get much love this week. Reading pull off a stunning comeback to defeat West Brom 3-2. Clive, do you believe in dramatic victories that energize an underdog and send them on their way to safety?
I'm not sure I believe in them. I suppose there's a slight precedent from last season. People talk about QPR's comeback against Liverpool that kind of got them going and kept them up, I suppose. It was a remarkable game. I had to laugh when I heard McDermott say, you know, I'll fondly look back on those last 9 minutes. And I suppose if they use him like a golfer who visualises a great shot when he has to face with the same scenario again, then if Reading can hang on and keep in their mind what happened in those last 9 minutes, then yes, it could possibly help them. I don't think they're good enough to stay up, to be quite honest. I think they are, as Rory said, Wigan surprisingly down there, even though they are playing very well. Reading, not consistent enough, not got enough quality in that team to stay in the Premier League. But if they can hang on to what the sort of spirit that happened in that last 9 minutes, who knows?
Ricky gets the better of Paul in the Battle of the Lamberts as Southampton win at Villa 1-0, but a lot hinged on that penalty awarded after Jay Rodriguez fell over. Ollie, your take?
Total dive, and I was considering doing a thing where I pretended I thought Jerry Rodriguez was Spanish, but I'm not going to do that. It was, I mean, people make apologies for that kind of dive, and maybe some of you would, but this answer has fallen to the wrong person if you want defensive diving. People will say, you know, the leg was there, he had to take evasive action. Well, for decades and decades and decades, people didn't take evasive action in that manner. It's a ludicrous defence and apology of the dive. If you think there's something morally right about diving, well, you're welcome to that opinion, but I think it's a shabby way to win a game, but I don't suppose Southampton will care, because that is a very, very valuable 3 points.
Jonathan Walters, it's a bad day to say the least. 2 own goals and a missed penalty, and Chelsea win 4-0 at Fortress Britannia. But Rory, Ba got the nod over Torres up front. Rory, you've read Rafa Benitez's book, so I'm guessing you might have some insight. Does he really have the cojones to bench El Nino on a permanent basis?
I don't think I actually have read it, to be fair. I think he probably does have the cojones to bench Torres on a permanent basis. Yes, whether he will or not, I don't think so. I suspect he's brought Bar in as cover, as supplement, as an occasional replacement. I think at Chelsea, Torres remains the main man for the next 6 months at least. If Benitez can't get him firing, then he won't be there for longer than 6 months, and I suspect neither will Torres. And Gab, one for you. I hear Juventus spent much of the winter break training and having a mini pre-season. How have things worked out for them since?
Absolutely rotten, Rory, because they went into it with an 8-point lead, and now they've dropped 5 points. They lost at home against the Sampdoria side down to 10 men, and this weekend they drew 1-1 with Parma. There's some absences, a lack of intensity. People are saying it's fatigue from all those two-a-days, which Conte had them do, which supposedly will pay off in April. I don't think they're in danger of not winning Serie A, but it's time to pull the proverbial finger out. That's all we've got time for this week. It's been fun, and it's been real, and it's been real fun, thanks to my guests, Rory K. Smith, Clive Petty, and, of course, Ollie K., speaking to you from his lovely conservatory in snowbound Rippenden. You can find us on Twitter to share your thoughts, or you can email gamepodcast@thetimes.co.uk. So many of you do it every week, and we love to hear from all of you. Go to thetimes.co.uk for all your news, your views, your web chats, your blogs, your analysis, whatever you might need about this wonderful game we call football. Till next week, bye-bye.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt, so throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.